The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
The FT. Hello and welcome to this end of year edition of the FT's World Weekly Podcast. We're devoting this whole programme to a discussion of the major geopolitical upheaval of the year, the Arab Spring. I'm Gideon Rachman. With me are David Gardner, our International Affairs Editor, and Rula Khalafar, Middle East Editor. David, this whole thing got going in January of this year, and I remember I was in Abu Dhabi and receiving an email which was sent to many of us in the FT saying, talking of President Ben Ali of Tunisia, who had fled, and you said, I think the precise words were, the buggers scarpered, so much for Arab strongmen. Was that the moment when we all realised that there was something really big going on that would become a regional event?
I think at that stage, you couldn't necessarily extrapolate to the rest of the region. I mean, it clearly put a huge dent in the armour of the Arab national security state. But I think when we really saw that it was game on was about 3 or 4 days into Tahrir Square, when the security forces retreated. And when, despite the initial repression, people just kept on pouring into the streets in their tens of thousands. At that point, it was clear that this was pan-regional.
Mm. And Rula, I mean, a lot of people said, oh, well, Middle East specialists didn't see this coming. I'm not sure that's true, actually. I mean, a lot of people have been saying for a long time that the Arab world, North Africa, was failing its people, that these governments weren't stable. But I guess we didn't see, nobody could see exactly how the edifice would begin to crumble.
I think a lot of people saw the symptoms. A very young generation, very frustrated generation, no economic prospects, repression, police brutality. So whether in Tunisia, in Egypt, or, you know, everywhere else, I think everyone knew that at some point things could explode. But I think the spark nobody foresaw, and particularly that it would be in Tunisia, because Tunisia had this image of having provided at least a minimum of improved living standards. And, you know, Ben Ali was praised. And the French thought that he was actually providing a model for the rest of the region. You know, a repressive regime, but a regime that cared about the economy and that cared about its people, which turned out not to be true. Even the figures that we'd been provided were not accurate. So I think if you go back to December, because this actually started on the 17th of December, and there were two phases in Tunisia. There was a first phase where the provinces were in rebellion. And then at the beginning of January, it moved to the outskirts of Tunis. And in the beginning, there were also protests in Algeria. And I remember very clearly that the protests in Tunisia and in Algeria did give a sense of something different going on at the end of this year, at the end of last year, at the beginning of this year. And although Algeria didn't develop into a full-blown uprising, I think that you had already a sense that young people were taking matters into their own hands from very, very early on.
And since then, of course, we've seen the revolution in Egypt, we've seen the overthrow of Gaddafi, a semi-civil war in Syria, upheavals in the Gulf, the fall of the president of Yemen, and so on. So the process is continuing to unfold. I mean, do you think we're looking now at a decade of upheaval in the Arab world?
Well, you know, if you ask politicians in Egypt, they say, they'll tell you Egypt's transition will take probably a decade. But yes, I think this is a process that doesn't have a beginning and or an end, and that does not have to go in the same way of in the same revolutionary way that we saw this year. There are countries like Morocco where we're seeing evolution and not revolution. I think in parts of the Gulf as well, Oman in particular, there are changes that are taking place that will lead to a different political system, but a lot more gradually. And these changes will take a very long time.
David, over the next 12 months, say, which is probably as much as we can look forward to, what do you think the big pressure points are going to be? What would you guess will be the biggest stories in the Middle East?
Syria. Beyond question. Because of its relative centrality, because of the turn it has already taken, you mentioned, I think civil war, although the UN has chosen to classify it in that way pretty much, or at least the human rights outfit in the UN, I don't think it has reached that stage. In the more than pedantic sense that you need two more or less equal sides or even multiple sides for a civil war, it seems to me that what has happened is that a stream of defections has taken place from the army. A pole of resistance has been erected, which does two things. I mean, one, raises the price of the regime's repression and perhaps causes some people pause for thought. But more importantly, it provides, particularly as international backing crystallizes around the opposition, it provides an umbrella for further defections. And therefore, I would have thought the tactic that they're looking at is not some sort of conventional defeat of the Syrian apparatus of repression, but to split the Syrian army.
I remember earlier in the year when we were discussing Libya a lot, you were mm-hmm. very adamant from the beginning that Gaddafi was finished, that he would go. Mm-hmm. Would you be so bold to say the same about Assad, that he's finished?
Absolutely, and I have been saying for many months. There isn't a path of return for the Assads, nor, crucially, have they left any path of retreat for their opponents. Therefore, this has been, I would say, since the end of April, a fight to the death. The position of the Assads is eroding. They've burnt virtually every international bridge. Iran is not going to come to their rescue. It may have put in, say, initially, technicians to help them monitor social media and that sort of thing. There are 300 to 400 revolutionary guards at their disposal inside the country and so on, but not much in the way of cash, and they're running out of cash. Okay. They're losing also because of international pressure on the regime. The regime is toxic to its business partners, some of them coerced, some of them voluntary. That is beginning to fade away. But the critical thing is that their military capacity is finite. You can't, alchemically rejig the demography of the country, which is reflected in the army. And basically, they have only two absolutely reliable, that is to say, Alawite units. They cannot, they expected to finish this by the end of April. Then there was the Ramadan offensive. Each time they think they can do it, but what as time goes on, what we've seen is they cannot hold down the country. Mm. Now, the minute that the opposition begins to get its act together and offer a degree of comfort to minorities, including the Alawites, the Christians who have tended to align with an Alawite-based regime, and begin to offer a coherent program, then I think the erosion accelerates. Hmm. The cohesion, such as it is, of the army decomposes.
Rula, what are the regional implications of what are going on in Syria? Because I sense a degree of nervousness. The Arab League has been pretty strong, actually, in coming out and condemning the Assad government, but the Iranians obviously are close to the Syrian government, the current Syrian government. Even the Israelis, who've had a very cold relationship with the Assad government, seem to be anxious about
it going?
Well, for the Israelis, Assad has kept the borders quiet, and that's a priority for them. I mean, he's used proxies in Lebanon to torment Israel, but at least the border between Syria and Israel has been, in fact, the most quiet border. So they have an interest in having. I mean, they don't care what's going on inside a country. In fact, it was very interesting that a couple of days ago, Benjamin Netanyahu's deputy had a briefing saying that the Arabs are simply not ready for democracy. And he didn't say which Arabs he was talking about, but, you know.
Well, Netanyahu gave a speech more or less saying the same thing, did he not?
Absolutely. So I think the problem with Syria, and this is what everybody is, you know, that's the reason that we're not at a stage of any kind of international intervention, is that it is, you know, it's a much more strategic country. It has a certain power of destruction. In fact, a lot of people are now very worried about what's going on in South Lebanon because the French have openly accused the Syrian regime of stirring trouble in South Lebanon and of promoting attacks on the UN peacekeeping forces. I mean, part of what David was describing as this apparent resilience of the regime so far, it has to do with the fact that they can be extremely ruthless. Mm. I mean, if you try to defect, say you're a diplomat, you try to defect, they will not only go after your parents and your children, they'll go after your cousin, your nieces, it's the element of the risk of retaliation is one of the things that people think about when they're thinking of, you know, what do we do about Syria? Mm. The other, of course, is the risk that Iran or Hezbollah could be drawn in if say there was an intervention led by Turkey and some of the Arab countries. This is the fear, is that it will not end in Syria, but it will spread and it'll be the spark of a regional confrontation.
Well, what about the Gulf? I mean, another element of the Arab Spring was the uprising in Bahrain, now apparently suppressed, but of course people look at, you know, old autocratic regimes. They must look at Saudi Arabia and the stability of that country. What's your feeling about how the Gulf has played into the Arab Spring?
I think that we've seen everything in the Gulf, and it's not true that, you know, the monarchies of the Gulf have been immune. I think every country has reacted in some way. First of all, through financial handouts. There's been, I mean, Saudi Arabia, over $100 billion has been pledged this year. So the Saudis, I think, have bought time. They've been able to delay any kind of popular move within the country. But there is a problem, a brewing problem in the eastern province amongst the Shia. And we have had a series of small demonstrations. So that's one thing to keep an eye on over the coming year. Bahrain, it's not over in Bahrain. Yes, it was crushed and the Saudis intervened. But there has not been a solution to Bahrain. And in fact, the protests are kicking off again in the Shia villages. They don't get as much attention only because the protesters cannot reach Manama. But every Friday, the Shia villages are, a lot of people are on the streets and the crackdown is continuing. Oman is an interesting case. There were protests mainly against unemployment, but the Sultan has gone quite far in responding, and not only with financial and economic measures, but also with political reforms.
Okay.
I think just to pick up on that, if I may, I mean, just Rula earlier mentioned to Morocco and so on. I mean, there will be no country unaffected by this, that's for sure. I think we can already see that. But the responses can be different. It seems to me that, you know, the Republican dynasties, which have clearly borne the brunt of the first phase, what are the options for the monarchies and not just of the Gulf? I mean, Jordan, for example, admittedly for the umpteenth time, is announcing a program of gradual movement towards constitutional monarchy. That will eventually have to be the option that Saudi Arabia contemplates. And it isn't as though this isn't part of the currency of debate in in Saudi Arabia. And there's a document which was asked for by King Abdullah, then Crown Prince, in 2003, which was presented to him, and which is essentially a blueprint for constitutional monarchy. It's in the water.
Let me finish by looking at the kind of broader international perspective, because another significant event as the year ends is the US is pulling out of Iraq. Is this part of a general trend, the Americans pulling out of Iraq, but also the Arab Spring, which sees American power in retreat in the Middle East? And if it is, who's going to fill the gap? Where are the outsiders going to come from? Will it be Turkey? Will it be Iran? Rula, what do you think?
Well, I think the U.S. has been in retreat in the region for a long time. The withdrawal from Iraq does, in my opinion, particularly for Iraq itself, it does open up the country to greater influence, greater Iranian influence. But the changes that we're seeing this year are also about Arabs taking their destiny into their own hands. So I think the time for outside powers having as much influence in the Middle East as over the past few decades is over. Now, obviously, Egypt needs to get its act together to be able to fill the gap. And there's going to be a constant struggle over the next few years between internal challenges and projecting yourself diplomatically in the region. This is why, for instance, it is those two elements that are allowing Qatar, for example, to play a much larger role today.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there for this year. So, Rula, thanks very much. And thanks also to David Gardner for your thoughts today and over the course of the year. This is the last edition of World Weekly for 2011. We'll be back in the new year.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.